The story of the 10 lepers, Luke 17:11-19. Now it happened as he went to Jerusalem that he passed through the midst of Samaria and Galilee. Then as he entered a certain village, there met him 10 men who were lepers who stood afar off. And they lifted up their voices and said, "Jesus, Master, have mercy on us." So when he saw them, he said to them, "Go, show yourselves to the priests." And so it was that as they went, they were cleansed. And one of them, when he saw that he was healed, returned, and with a loud voice glorified God and fell down on his face at his feet, giving him thanks. And he was a Samaritan. So Jesus answered and said, "Were there not 10 cleansed? But where are the 9? Were there not any found who returned to give glory to God except this foreigner?" And he said to him, "Arise, go your way, your faith has made you well." We're nearing the end of our series on parables, just a couple more weeks to go. But this morning we come to a passage which is not a parable. It's an actual event, like Jesus' encounter with Nicodemus or with the woman at the well. I mentioned in the introduction that we'd be doing this story the Sunday before Thanksgiving, because it's certainly about Thanksgiving. The one returns falling down at Jesus' feet, giving him thanks. And Jesus, it seems, rather mournfully asks, "Where's everybody else?" The study turns on the contrast between the one who returned to give thanks and the 9 who did not. So it's a true life story, but we also noted that it, quote, quote, reads like a parable. That is, it's a brief, self-contained story with a distinct point. And we also noted that while in one sense the distinction between parables and real life is clear and simple, parables are made-up stories and real life is real, in another sense, parables and real life are very much alike. Just as parables are like life, life is like a parable. Parables are stories that are about something else. Our lives are stories about something else. The world's a stage, and heaven is the audience. Our thoughts, our words, and our deeds don't end here. They ripple through eternity with eternal consequences, for better or worse, depending on our relationship to Jesus, which not coincidentally brings us back to our story. And let's go over it again to make sure we know what's going on. Now it happened as he went to Jerusalem that he passed through the midst of Samaria and Galilee. Jesus is traveling south towards Jerusalem. In Luke's narrative, this is his final fatal journey. And he travels right through the midst of Samaria and Galilee. He's taken a straight line route from Galilee farthest north through Samaria. And that's remarkable because the Jews' contempt for the Samaritans was so great that they would usually spend a couple of extra days on the road, everybody's walking, to go around Samaria. So they wouldn't have to go through it. But for whatever reason, Jesus didn't care. So he just went straight through. Then as he entered a certain village, there met him 10 men who were lepers who stood afar off. And they stood afar off because they had to. They were lepers. They were unclean. And let's take a moment to consider their plight, which was unique and uniquely horrible. We think of the ancient world as primitive, and obviously it was in terms of technology, but people are the same everywhere all the time. Human nature hasn't changed one bit. And whatever the state of their medical knowledge, they knew that thing, leprosy, was contagious. The term, as it's employed in the Bible, covers a broader range of disease than what we would strictly call leprosy, but no form of it was good. 2 entire chapters of Leviticus are devoted to it, and they are long ones, chapters 13 and 14, 116 verses about the detection, examination, quarantine, and re-examination of leprosy for people, for clothing, and for houses. Concluding, Leviticus 14:54 and following, this is the law for any leprous sore and scale, for the leprosy of a garment and of a house, for a swelling and a scab and a bright spot, to teach when it is unclean and when it is clean. This is the law of leprosy. And the law of leprosy decreed that when clothing had it, it was to be burned. When a house had it, it was to be demolished. And when a person had it, they were to be banished, isolated, exiled. Leviticus 13:45 and following. Now the leper on whom the sore is, his clothes shall be torn and his head bare, and he shall cover his mustache and cry, unclean, unclean. He shall be unclean all the days he has the sore. He shall be unclean, he is unclean, and he shall dwell alone. His dwelling shall be outside the camp. They knew it was deadly, and they were drop-dead serious about containing it. But there's a footnote. He who is unclean shall cry, unclean, and he shall dwell alone. But if you've already got the disease, it's over. You're hosed. You've got nothing to lose. So you might as well hang out with other people who have the disease. Misery loves company. And lepers gathered, formed communities of a sort. They couldn't be around normal people, but they could be around one another. It's not a club you'd want to join, but if you found yourself elected, you'd join. Well, that's enough for now about leprosy. These 10 lepers probably comprise some sort of community, and as Jesus came by, they cry from afar off, Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. They'd certainly have heard of Jesus and his miraculous powers. The blind see, the deaf hear, the lame walk. Could lepers be cleansed? Didn't hurt to ask. And it was already something of a miracle that they were anywhere near him. Because unlike everyone else, they couldn't go to him, couldn't seek him out. We read of people bringing their sick to Jesus. There's a time when the guys couldn't get their paralyzed friend to him through the crowd, so they tore the roof off. That's aggressive. But lepers couldn't be aggressive in any way, shape, or form. They were unclean. And the clean would quickly stone them to death if they got anything like aggressive. You know the story about the woman who was subject to bleeding for 12 years. She was actually in the same boat. The bleeding she was subject to made her ritually unclean, so she was supposed to stay away from people because contact with her defiled them. But unlike the lepers, she could hide it. She could appear normal. So she was breaking the law, defiling people left and right as she pressed through that crowd to Jesus, but she didn't care. She was way beyond caring. She knew if she could just touch the hem of his garment, she'd be healed. So she did, and she was. But nothing like that for these guys. They weren't touching the hem of anybody's garment. Nobody was going to let them get anything like that close. No, they couldn't touch Jesus, but they could call to him, which they did from afar off, Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. So when he saw them, he said to them, go, show yourselves to the priests. Go, show yourselves to the priests. In Leviticus 13 and 14, the priests were designated as the examiners, the public health officials, if you will. It was their responsibility to examine and determine whether something was clean or unclean, and when it changed from one condition to another, and to announce it. So Jesus tells them to go to the priests, apparently implying that they will be healed. And it was no small act of faith for those lepers to set out for the priests because they were lepers. They've already been examined and pronounced unclean. There is no point in showing yourself to a priest unless something has changed. And when they set out, nothing had changed. Jesus performed no action nor spoke any word about healing them. Just told them to go show themselves to the priests, and they went. I don't know if it's something about leprosy that brings this out, but it reminds me of one of my favorite stories in the Old Testament, Naaman the leper, 2 Kings 5. Now Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great and honorable man in the eyes of his master, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was also a mighty man of valor, but a leper. And the Syrians had gone out on raids and brought back captive a young girl from the land of Israel. She waited on Naaman's wife. Then she said to her mistress, "If only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy." So, Naaman was a Syrian general, very effective commander, but a leper. This captive Israelite girl tells his wife he could be healed by a prophet in Samaria. That's another name for the northern kingdom of Israel. And Naaman went in and told his master, saying, "Thus and thus said the girl who is from the land of Israel." Then the king of Syria said, "Go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. So the king of Syria is sending his prized general Naaman to the king of Israel to be healed of leprosy. The silver, the gold, and the clothing are payment for this service. So this leprous Syrian general shows up at the court of the king of Israel and hands him a letter which reads, "Now be advised when this letter comes to you that I have sent Naaman my servant to you, that you may heal him of his leprosy." And it happened when the king of Israel read the letter that he tore his clothes and said, "Am I God to kill and make alive that this man sends a man to me to heal him of leprosy? Therefore, please consider and see how he seeks a quarrel with me." King of Israel thinks the king of Syria is just setting him up, asking an impossible favor so he can go, "Oh, you won't heal my leper. I attack." Perhaps also reflected here is the lack of faith of the king of Israel. There were never any good kings in the northern kingdom. He may not even have known of the prophet Elisha, or if he did, may not have believed God worked miracles through him. But Elisha hears about this. Now 2 Kings 5:8. "So it was when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, he sent to the king, saying, 'Why have you torn your clothes? Please let him come to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel.' Then Naaman went with his horses and chariot and stood at the door of Elisha's house. And Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, 'Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored to you, and you shall be clean.' But Naaman became furious and went away and said, 'Indeed, I said to myself, he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and heal the leprosy. Are not the Abana and the Pharpar, rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?' So he turned and went away in a rage." I love this story. What's going on here is that Naaman has apparently envisioned the manner in which he would be healed. He had expectations. And when Elisha just says, "Go and wash in the Jordan," he thinks it's a joke or a sham. Didn't come out all the way just to dunk in a river. He could have dunked in the rivers of Damascus far more easily. So he takes off in a huff, verse 13. "And his servants came near and spoke to him and said, 'My father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, would you not have done it? How much more then when he says to you, wash and be clean?'" The servant points out that if Elisha had told Naaman to go climb the highest mountain, he'd have done that. Or if he'd told him to fast for 40 days or walk on hot coals, he'd have done that. Since all he had to do was go down in the dunk in the Jordan, why not give it a try? Verse 14. So Naaman went down and dipped 7 times in the Jordan, according to the saying of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. Well, likewise with our 10 lepers, there's no big show. In fact, there's no show of any kind. Jesus just tells them to go and show themselves to the priests. And they have the faith to begin to do that. They set out, verse 14. And so it was that as they went, they were cleansed. That's the second half of verse 14, and that's all we're told. As they went, they were cleansed. We don't know if it was a little while or a long while. Don't know if it was sudden or gradual. Don't know if it was the same for all 10 or different for each one. We only know that as they went in faith, obeying Jesus, they were cleansed. And we know that all 10 were cleansed, but only one turned back. And one of them, when he saw that he was healed, returned, and with a loud voice glorified God and fell down on his face at his feet, giving him thanks. And he was a Samaritan. Jesus then rattles off a trio of rhetorical questions. Were there not 10 cleansed? But where are the 9? Were there not any found who'd return to give glory to God except this foreigner? Then concludes with the blessing, arise, go your way, your faith has made you well. Honestly, this bugs me a bit. Clearly, the point of this story is that what the Samaritan did was right, and the other 9 were wrong or bad or deficient. Yet they were doing exactly as they were told, obeying Jesus to the letter. They'd set out while still lepers to go show themselves to the priest. They're demonstrating great faith. You know, when the centurion asked Jesus to heal his servant, and Jesus says, okay, I'll come and heal him. The centurion says, you know, I'm not worthy you should come under my roof. You just speak the word, and my servant will be healed. I know how authority works. And Jesus marvels at this. He says, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel. Amen. The centurion trusted Jesus. He did not need his eyes to see. He only needed his ears to hear. Only speak a word, and my servant will be healed. That's faith. Well, it seems to me those lepers were trusting Jesus just about at that level. They took him at his word and set out to show themselves to the priests while they were still lepers. Nevertheless, he's disappointed. Were there not 10 cleansed? Where are the 9? Well, they're out there doing exactly what you told them to do. Are you expecting something more? Apparently so. Apparently so. It reminds me of another incident in the life of the prophet Elisha. This one near the end of his life, 2 Kings 13, beginning at verse 14. Elisha had become sick with the illness of which he would die. Then Joash, the king of Israel, came down to him and wept over his face and said, "Oh, my father, the chariots of Israel and their horsemen." The king is bemoaning the passing of Elisha, wondering what will happen to the armies of Israel. And Elisha said to him, "Take a bow and some arrows." So he took himself a bow and some arrows. Then he said to the king of Israel, "Put your hand on the bow." So he put his hand on it, and Elisha put his hands on the king's hands. And he said, "Open the east window." And he opened it. Then Elisha said, "Shoot." And he shot. And he said, "The arrow of the Lord's deliverance, and the arrow of deliverance from Syria. For you must strike the Syrians at Aphek till you have destroyed them." Then he said, "Take the arrows." So he took them. And he said to the king of Israel, "Strike the ground." So he struck the ground 3 times and stopped. And the man of God was angry with him. and said, you should have struck five or six times. Then you would have struck Syria till you had destroyed it. But now you will strike Syria only three times. I know this can be a little difficult to follow. Elisha is a prophet, and he's prophesying through symbolic actions, which he is instructing the king to perform. Take a bow, hand on the bow, open the window, shoot. The arrow represents the coming Israelite victory over Syria. Okay. Then Elisha says to the king, take the arrows. So he took them. Then Elisha said to the king, strike the ground. So he struck the ground. And this is either banging the arrows on the ground like this, or it might mean shoot the arrows into the ground. It's a little ambiguous. But either way, the king does it three times and then stops, and he's in trouble. He's done something wrong. Elisha says, you should have struck five or six times. Then you would have struck Syria till you had destroyed it. But now you will strike Syria only three times. Okay, the acts are prophetically symbolic. Striking the ground three times only brought three victories over Syria. And Elisha's upset because he wanted five or six. But how was Joash supposed to know that? There is nothing in the text. I mean, shoot, he struck the ground three times. That's a nice, he could have done it once. You know, boom, boom, boom. That's a nice rhythm to it, wraps it up. But he's chastised because he didn't do it more. This does not seem fair or reasonable to me. Was he supposed to know somehow? If so, I have no idea how. There is nothing I'm aware of in the text. But there it is. So obviously, I still have some more things to learn. In a similar way, the nine lepers who were explicitly obeying Jesus get called up short because they didn't do something above and beyond obedience. They did not give him thanks. As I reflect on this, the lesson I draw is that there's something more, something deeply personal, something almost too obvious to utter. And that is that we should be grateful, thankful to God. One way this comes to me is through the book of Romans, Paul's masterpiece. I think it is rightly called the Gospel according to Paul. Not that it's above Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but it's not below them either. After the introduction, which concludes with verses 16 and 17, for I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also for the Greek, for in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. After that, he launches into a section about the rebellion and condition of humanity in general. Romans 1, beginning at verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because what may be known about God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. I am of the opinion that he is essentially referring to Genesis 11 and the Tower of Babel incident, but that's a subject for another sermon, not our concern this morning. But there is a little phrase easy to miss, which is our concern. They're in Romans 1, 21. Although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful. In the grand scheme, his argument is that humanity already knows all about God, and we're suppressing it, lying to ourselves, lying to one another about it. Although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful. Although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God. The glory of God. Glorifying God. It's a rather large subject. If you're dialed into the essential message of the Bible, you are aware it is the subject. It's what it's all about. But that's where our little phrase comes in. Reading over it, it can sound like an afterthought. They did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful. But here's the point. Grammatically, logically, it is completely equal. They are perfectly balanced. They did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful. Being thankful is parallel with, as important as, glorifying him as God. And though I don't understand it all, our passage this morning makes it clear there is a profound connection. We got a bunch of lepers who desperately need a miracle, and they get one through the person of Jesus Christ. All 10 of them are healed, but only one of them, when he saw that he was healed, returned. And with a loud voice, glorified God and fell down on his face at his feet, giving him thanks. He glorified God and was thankful. Now, I bet the other nine, who were probably trucking temple word to show themselves to the priests, I bet they were glorifying God. And I'm sure they were thankful. So what's the problem? What's the difference? Only one of them returned. Only the Samaritan took the time and effort to close the loop personally. Thinking of glorifying God and being thankful as a pair, we might think of glorifying God as kind of the cognitive, intellectual aspect and being thankful as the personal, emotional aspect. We did the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector a few weeks ago, and you might recall the Pharisees represented a good idea gone to seed. And that good idea was to obey God. That's an excellent idea. It's a wonderful idea, but it's missing something. It's not the greatest idea. If it were the greatest idea, it'd be the greatest commandment. But the greatest commandment isn't obey the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. It's love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. Gratitude, like love, is incomplete until it is expressed. And it can only be expressed to a person. Try being grateful to an object, the sun or the moon or a tree, or your seatbelt or your life raft. Try it. It just doesn't work. Thankfulness only happens person to person. And the Samaritan was the only one who took the time and made the effort to close that loop with Jesus, falling down at his feet, giving him thanks. And that personal expression bore fruit. Though it doesn't explicitly say so, I think a saving relationship was established between that Samaritan former leper and Jesus. Jesus says, "Arise, go your way, your faith has made you well." And though my translation doesn't footnote it, many do, because the word translated well there is sozo, which is the common New Testament word for salvation. Occurs about 100 times, and it's usually translated to save, though contextually it can mean to be healthy, made healthy or whole. Your faith has healed you. Your faith, Jesus said to him, has sozoed you. Jesus used that exact phrase 4 times, and in each instance, it was to one who sought him out specifically. It's what he said to the woman who touched the hem of his garment. Matthew 9:22, "Be of good cheer, daughter, your faith has made you well." He says it to the blind man outside of Jericho, Luke 18:42, "Receive your sight, your faith has made you well." He says it to the immoral woman who washed his feet with her tears, Luke 7:50, "Your faith has saved you, go in peace." And it's translated saved there because it's in the context of sins rather than sickness. And he says it to the grateful Samaritan leper, Luke 17:19, "Arise, go your way, your faith has made you well." And though it's possible to read that only in terms of being healed, I think there's more there for a couple of reasons. First, he's not any more well than the other nine are. They're all healed, and the other nine are trucking down the road somewhere. So Jesus, it seems, is expressing something more to him. The difference is he came back to thank Jesus. Also, in this specific context, other words are used. Verse 14, they were cleansed. Remember, lepers were unclean. And in verse 15, it says, when he saw that he was healed, he returned. Healed there is a more specifically medical term. So I think the time and effort he took and the faith he exhibited to glorify God and personally thank Jesus sozoed him. I expect we'll see him in the by and by, and perhaps we can express our gratitude to him for showing us that thankfulness can and should be personally expressed to God. Lord, thank you for the perfect example of your life and how we can look at any incident and from any angle and see precious truths there. Lord, would you help my heart to go beyond the frame, the rules, the whatever, the what's required, and ascend to that more personal and glorious thing, to be grateful to you. Would you bless us and expand the thankfulness in our hearts to you? Amen.